Thank you. Well, as the blurb for this talk said, by the way, I just want to check, is this working? Okay. As the blurb for this talk said, this is aimed at undergraduates who've taken and understood calculus. And I chose the topic in part because of the influence of my own daughter, who's an undergraduate, though not a math major, but I mean, she was always fascinated by this question of what is infinity factorial, rather fascinated by the assertion that I would make. So let's start by just asking that question, since that is the title of the talk. So what is now, of course, one of the ways that, at least I these days answer such questions is rather than thinking, I just type it into Google. And now, what's interesting is, at least up until a couple of weeks ago, if you type this into Google, the thing that came top, in fact, answered the question correctly. Okay, so infinity factorial is the square root of 2 pi. Now, unfortunately, where I found this, or rather where Google found it, I should say, was some discussion board on a science forum run by the Australian Broadcasting Network. And after the person at the top of the list said this, everyone afterwards then started to disagree. So for those who don't know what this means, let me just explain. This means that if we take the product 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 and keep going, ad infinitum, I claim this is the square root of 2 pi. And so the question is, you know, why, how do I get to make what is on the face of it such an absurd statement? and I'll try also to give some indication of why people might think this is important, though I think that's a slightly harder task. Now, and I think in the poster for the talk, a couple of other sums were mentioned. I think the other one that was mentioned was, if I remember correctly, this one. And there are a number of such similar formulae. So all of these fall under the heading of, clearly, from the point of view of calculus, divergent theories. And the question is, so the general question is, how and why do we assign values to divergent sums, and products? So I, you know, in some sense, the subtitle to this might be, why you shouldn't believe everything that your calculus teacher tells you. Because, I mean, the way we teach calculus these days, we relay sort of emphasis on the whole epsilon delta method, and what we tell the students is that if I want to take a sum, such as some one of these up here, so I should, maybe I should say, point out that if I want to take this infinite product, take an infinite product, of course, to multiply is the same as adding, except that we have to take logarithms. So, well, this is the same as, for computing this, is equivalent after taking the logarithm to adding. So log okay, so in calculus we're taught that if we have a series, so to sum this series of numbers is the same thing as figuring out the product 1 times 2 times 3 times 4 and so on. So we're taught, of course, that a series like this, at least we teach in calculus, that this makes sense if the sequence converges. Scientific example would be something like a geometric series. Now let's see, I have to remember here. Okay. So if we have a geometric series, something like 1 plus a half plus a quarter, then this sums to 2 because the sequence of partial sums converges to 2. In other words, if I add up the first n of these, what I get is 2 minus by algebra. And so as n gets larger and larger, 1 over 2 to the n plus 1 gets smaller and smaller, and so it's legitimate to say that the sum of this series is equal to 2. But if you go back to the 18th century, to Euler, this distinction was not so obvious. So the distinction between convergent and divergent was unclear. So for example, a series so the series 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 and so on. in the 18th century, it wasn't clear whether this should be viewed as having a sum or not. So for example, I gather, and I should say, by the way, when I say I gather, I'm by no means a historian of mathematics. I have not read the original source material, and so So all of my historical remarks, I'm depending on having read, sort of browsed through the American Mathematical Monthly for relevant quotations. But I think that, this seems to be a pretty accurate story of what the situation was. So Bernoulli, for example, looked at this and said, if I look at the partial sums, so if I had to look at the SNs, we start off with 1, then 1 minus 1 is 0, 1, 0, 1. So half the time the sum is 1, half the time the sum is 0, and sort of from a probabilistic point of view, you sort of should take the average, and the sum should be a half. And by the same logic, if you take 1 plus 0 plus negative 1 plus 1 plus 0 plus negative 1, so in other words, you take the previous series and just add in zeros every 3 terms, then the partial sums are 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0. And so by exactly the same logic, the sum should be 2/3. Now there's another way of thinking about this sum, which I think was also known at that point, which goes back to this geometric series up here, which says, well, let's look. So we know that if I take a geometric series, 1 plus r plus r squared, that if the absolute value of r is less than 1, then this is equal to 1 over 1 minus r. So in the sequence, in the series up at the top there, we took r equal to a half. Well, here, why not just take r equal to minus 1. So we get 1 plus 1 plus, sorry, I mean 1 minus 1 r, yeah, r equals negative 1. Sorry, 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1. And then if I just plug in r equals negative 1, I get a half. So, I mean, some people say, well, sort of in the 18th century, they just didn't really understand what convergence is all about. But other sources I've read indicate that at least Euler was pretty clear about, pretty clear maybe is an exaggeration, but that Euler sort of understood that there were certain theories which very definitely converged, and other theories which, even though if they didn't necessarily converge, there still was some logic behind through which you could assign a value to the sum of the series. So, and you could really ask this sort of general question, which is something that I think by and large we don't attempt to confuse students with in calculus, which is, given a sequence of numbers, can we add them in some reasonable fashion? So what does it mean to add them? Well, you assign some number, and then you expect this number to have some kind of reasonable properties. And typically, the kinds of properties that you look for are number one, that if the series converges, let me just write through a0 plus a1 is equal. So this is the usual sense of convergence. Another thing is that you add one series to another. So if you can add these guys, and you can add these guys, then you'd like the sum of this plus this to be equal . But notice, I mean, so and then the third thing you might like, and then the third property you might like is that let's say a0 plus . So in other words, we could actually just say, let's just pick some series. You know, for example, this one right here. Assign an arbitrary value to that series. You know, let's just say infinity factorial is going to be equal to 2. And then every series we get sort of by this process, either by adding two series or by, we'd have some class of series which we could add them up. And so there's a sense here in which you take a series. So if a series has an obviously infinite sum, just try sort of subtracting infinity from its sum. So from that sum, or from the series, let's say. And hope you can do so consistently. So this actually is a little bit similar to something that happens in physics, about which I cannot claim to be an expert, but so this is similar to the process of renormalization. So there's this unfortunate thing in physics that when one tries to compute by certain methods, sort of the self-energy of an electron, let's say, you get infinite numbers. And so you have to have some process for coming up with a finite answer, and in some crude sense, the trick is to throw away the right infinity so that you're left with something finite. So that's sort of what we want to do here. So some of the time, maybe I should make a distinction between sort of two different theories for a second. We have this series where there's some logic to saying the sum of the series is a half. There's this series, namely, or the infinite product, where at the moment there's no particular logic to saying the value, the infinite product is square root of 2 pi. But I want to sort of link these two. And to do that, let's go back to, let's go back to both the 17th and 18th centuries. So one of the things I want to explain is sort of the connection between the value of infinity factorial and Wallace formula for pi. So Wallace was one of the, so I guess in the history of calculus, you sort of have Cavalieri, who was the first person to integrate x, to compute the area under the curve y equals x to the n. And then Wallace sort of extended Cavalieri's work and was sort of, I think, very influential in Newton's thinking about calculus. And so Wallace, what Wallace wanted to do was he wanted to compute the area under a circle. So thanks to Cavalieri and then Wallace, one knew, maybe not completely rigorously, but one knew how to integrate things like integral from 0 to 1 of x to the n, in other words, the area under y equals x to the n. And you could replace x to the n thanks, so that was Cavalieri, and then thanks to Wallace, you could replace x to the n by polynomials and by square roots. So the question was, could you integrate this guy? So this being the area of the quarter circle. So the answer should be pi by 4. And Wallace, I guess, tried pretty hard to come up with a value, sort of a process by which you could do this integral. And so what he discovered, I guess, sort of by trial and error, was that if you looked at integral powers of 1 minus x squared, there was a recursive formula relating the value of this integral for a given n to the value for n plus 1 or n plus 2. And so by finding a recursive formula for these integral powers of 1 minus x squared, he basically guessed, so Wallace guessed a recursive formula for this integral right here, for the integral square root of 1 minus x squared, and this recursive formula is the following. Infinite product. The thing to notice about this infinite product is if I look at the partial term, the product first n terms, it goes 2, and then you multiply by something less than 1, then you multiply by something greater than 1, and so the values, so you start off at 2, it goes down a bit because you multiply by 2/3, so you go down to 4/3, then you go up and you multiply by less than you've basically divided by the previous term. And so this somewhere in the middle here is the value of this infinite product. And so let's just call this W. And the only question is, why is W equal to pi over 2? It should be a 6, thank you. Yeah, that's the problem with writing something when you're an autopilot and thinking, just, you know, is this a geometric series or is this a... So, yeah, let's write a couple more terms in here. So 3, 3, 5, 5, 7, and now we have 8. Okay. Now, so here's a little exercise which I won't do. So ignore all questions of convergence, right? So if infinity factorial equals square root of 2 pi, deduce Wallace's formula. I mean, this is actually not completely obvious because at some point you're going to have to use a formula which I think was on the board but got erased. But I mean, clearly there's a similarity between the two. And so that's something that I... So going back to Euler, so Wallace, I guess, died at the end of the 17th century, 1700 something, I think. And then Euler, who was active soon thereafter. So one of the things Euler did is he computed things like 1 plus 1 plus, and then more generally 1 plus 2 to the k plus 3 to the k. So for an integer. Now, this in particular, if you look in the American Mathematical Monthly or lots of places, and there's a large literature about this. And what are we doing here? Well, really, we're looking at the Riemann zeta function. That's cool, the Riemann zeta function, but it was considered by Euler, the difference being Euler considered really only looked at real values of f. So we know from calculus that this converges well, if f, let's say if S is a real, let's say if S is a complex number, if the real part of S is greater than 1. I thought a lot of wonderful, I mean, I'm not going to really discuss this, but I mean, you can sort of using calculus, you can figure out values. For example, zeta of 2 is pi squared over 6, and this can be interpreted as saying that the probability, that two numbers are coprime, in other words, have no common factors other than plus or minus 1, well, two, say, non-negative numbers, a coprime, is 6 over pi squared. So, Riemann zeta function has to do with density of primes. There's a lot, lots of wonderful properties it has. But I just want to concentrate on its value at negative integers. As I said, Euler actually computed, in some sense, what the value of the zeta function was at negative integers. And in fact, let's see, yeah, so let's... Yeah, and in fact, before I sort of say what Euler did, let me, if you think back to here, let me just say a word about what's involved here with summing these series. So in this case, so to say that 1 minus 1 plus 1, etc., is equal to 1 half, by this argument here, is in fact what's called Abel summation. So Abel summation says if, so A1, or actually A0, A1, is a sequence such that first of all, this power series converges for the absolute value of x less than 1. So here, a typical example is a geometric series where the ans are all plus or minus 1. So, or and secondly, if the limit as x approaches 1, but x is less than 1, of this sum exists, then equals f, then we say so the series is what's called Abel summable. And the reason for the terminology Abel summable is that what Abel proved, remember I don't know if it's still there, yeah. So the statement that if the series actually converges, then what you get over there really is the sum of the series in the usual sort of sense of calculus is a theorem of Abel. But this series that we had right here, 1 minus 1, et cetera, is an example of a series which is Abel summable but is not convergent. So in fact, Abel summation satisfies all three properties, 1, 2, and 3, which was the one on the board underneath. There's a second, another kind of, and there are lots of kinds of summation. There's another kind of summation which is really in the spirit, in fact, really is essentially what I guess Bernoulli said, which is what's called Cesaro summation. Which says that if you have A0, A1, and now you look at the first n terms and take the partial sum, and now what you do is if the average, so S0 plus Sn, so the average of the first, actually this should be n plus 1, first n plus 1 partial sums, if that average has a limit, then the sequence is said to be Cesaro summable. So if this has a limit, then the sequence is Cesaro summable. And again, this definition has the property that if the sequence you started with was already convergent, then you get the same answer. But there are sequences, and I mean, the sequence 1 minus 1 plus 1 and so on is an example. Or the sequence, if I take 1, the other sequence I wrote down, 1 plus 0 minus 1 plus 0, well, that's equal in this sense. If you compute the partial sums, that's what you get. And I should say, yeah, and one remark here is if the sequence is Cesaro summable, then the sequence is arbor summable. Okay. Now, I mean, however, both of these methods of summation, as more or less implied earlier on, they work fine they're reasonable methods of summation for sequences of terms which of the form of, say, 1 minus 1 plus 1, in other words, where they're not diverging to infinity. On the other hand, this method, this Arbol summation method, sort of gives you a hint of what we want to do with the Riemann zeta function. Because really what this does is it says, we're going to find some function. In this case, it's the function sum of the power series a n x to the n. But we're going to find some function so that a value of that function at some point is going to be the sum of our series. And if we can do that in a sufficiently reasonable way, then the sum should have reasonable properties. And so it turns out that for these sort of brutally divergent series up here, that the Riemann zeta function is just such a function. So the idea is that, I mean, from a sort of more modern point of view, a post-Euler point of view, is that if we think of the Riemann zeta function, this sum of 1 over n to the s, if we think of s as a complex number, so now here's the complex plane, and what we're trying to do is compute the values of this function at points like this. So in s equals 0, we've got the sum n equals 0 to infinity of 1. And at a point like minus k, we have the sum n equals 1 to infinity n to the power k. So the idea is if I have this function zeta of s, which on the face of it only makes sense when s, or the real part of s, is bigger than 1, that in fact we can make this into a function which makes sense everywhere for every complex number, it turns out, except for s equals 1. And then the value of zeta of s at negative k is going to be the sum of this series. So, I mean, the way I'm describing it here, of course, is just for the principle, more or less, the principle of analytic continuation. The trick is, how can you construct this function? So sort of Arbol summation, it was completely clear. I mean, you have the sequence of numbers, you form this series, and if the series converges, then, and the limit exists, you're just taking the value of the function of x equals 1. Well, certainly, I mean, when I first learned this, it was a bit of a surprise. I mean, after reading all the standard number theory books about the functional equation and so on, was, you know, when I first realized, you know, read that sort of there were these very elementary methods of doing this due to Euler, it came as something of a surprise to me. I'm not going to give the whole argument of how one computes the values of all these guys. So let me just say, just for the sake of completeness, what actually is the value here. So this is minus, where this is for k greater than or equal to 1. So these are the Bernoulli numbers where x over e to the x minus 1 . And so this computation of the sum of n to the k in terms of the Bernoulli numbers was done by Euler. Okay, so let's try and compute what's sort of going on just at s equals 0 using sort of the method that he used. And this will kind of bring us, hopefully, to Wallace's formula. Okay, so we start as I said before, as we know from calculus, sort of a standard thing that appears in calculus texts, this makes sense so long as S is bigger than 1. I guess using the integral test or whatever. Now, let me also write down the following. So this converges again, certainly by the comparison test. But then notice, in fact, that this is now an alternating series with decreasing terms, and so it converges, not absolutely, but it still converges by as an alternating series. So long as S is positive. Okay. So now let's add these guys together. Well, sorry, actually, I guess I want to subtract. So now I all the odd terms cancel off, and so we get twice . Now let's take out a factor . So this is 2 to the 1 minus S . So we get the fun. So, and this makes perfectly good sense for anybody who worries about this, for S bigger than 1. So in other words, we've taken this function zeta of s defined for s bigger than 1, and now we've done this nice trick, because this says that zeta of s, if my arithmetic here is correct, is 1 over 1 minus 2 to the 1 minus s times L of s. So if I put s equal to 1, if I look at just this, if I put s equal to 1, then I get 2 to the power of 0, which is 1, and this is infinite. So what we've done here is this is infinite when s equals 1, and this is finite for s bigger than 0. So as I said earlier on, one of the tricks one of the sort of goals in trying to add up these divergent series is to somehow subtract off an infinity and be left with something finite. And in essence, that's what we've done right here. Now, we're not quite done, because remember what we were interested in doing, you know, one of the things I said, we want to compute, for example, 1 plus 1 plus 1 and so on. So, yeah, so what's, you know. So this is zeta 0. Okay, just put s equal to 0 here. But now, you know, what's the other reason you want to understand zeta at s equals 0? Well, let's look again at the sum. Now, if we differentiate, this is e to the minus f log n. If I differentiate e to the minus s log n, I get minus log n over n to the s. So in other words, the derivative, at least for s bigger than 1, of this function is the sum, n equals 1 to infinity, minus log n over n to the s. Now, that means that just purely formally, zeta prime to 0 should be the sum n equals minus, sorry, n equals 1 to infinity of minus log n, or in other words, it should be minus log infinity factorial. So really, when I said at the very beginning that infinity factorial is the square root of 2 pi, what I really meant true because infinity factorial is e to the minus zeta prime to 0, and zeta prime to 0 is minus log square root of 2 pi. So that's, so we have this assertion, so we have really two assertions. We have this, and we also have the assertion that zeta 0 is minus 1 half. And those are two things. So this was definitely known to Euler. Whether Euler literally knew this, I don't know. But I suspect if someone had bothered to ask him, he would have certainly have known how to compute. Okay, so we're just about done with sort of getting, in terms of getting to s equals 0, except that here we have this L of s. So if I want to compute, for example, let's just fix on zeta of 0. If I want to know zeta of 0, I put s equal to 0, 1 over 1 minus 2 to the power 1. So that gives me a negative 1 here times L of 0. Well, now, how do I compute L of 0? If I go up to the L of S there, I put S equal to 0, I get 1 minus 1 plus 1 and so on. Well, you could already say, well, we just computed a few minutes ago 1 minus 1 plus 1, right? So this is, by either Abel or Cesaro, this is 1 half. And so I already get minus 1 half right there. Well, we can go a step further. And in fact, actually, by manipulating this series, we can actually get a function which not only can we evaluate, but we can differentiate. So the trick, and this is sort of the thing that really allowed Euler to sort of move further and further to the left and allowed him to compute the values of the zeta function at more and more at k for k, the negative k, I should say, for larger and larger k. Let's see what's the terminology here. So this is what's called the Euler transformation. So if I have some sum like this from alternating series, we're not even assuming that the AIs are positive. You just write it with alternating signs. Then you rewrite it like this. See. In other words, you express the previous infinite series in terms of a new series which is made up out of the successive differences, or the differences of successive terms. And what you hope is that the differences of successive terms will actually be a lot smaller than the term in absolute value in the terms of the series you started with. And so this will have better convergence properties. So if you do this, then you get, you get 1 half, 1 plus 1 over 2 to the minus s, minus 1 over 2 to the s, minus 3 to the s, plus, and so on. Okay, so this is L of S. Now here's a fact which you can prove by elementary calculus, just by figuring out the sort of the maximum value of these terms on the interval from 0 to negative 1. This converges to S bigger than negative 1. So in other words, if you rewrite the series like this, you get a new function, or you get a function which is now defined, which takes the same values as L of S, as L of S is the sum of this series is for S bigger than 0, this new function works for S bigger than minus 1. And so in particular, I can use this expression right here to compute, let's say, the value of L of S at S equals 0. Well, if I put S equal to 0 here, what do I get? Well, I get 1 minus 1, 1 minus 1. Everything else collapses to 0 except for the 1 half. So that gives me the 1 half I wanted over there for L of 0. And now what happens if we differentiate? And L prime is 0. So the thing to remember is if I take n to the minus s and differentiate and then put s equal to 0, I get negative log n. So I do that up here. What do I get? Well, we get L prime is 0. We get 1 half. The derivative of 1 is 0. We get we get plus log 2 from here. Then we get minus. Here we have minus log 2 plus log 3 plus, and then the next term, well, it'll be 1 half. We have 3 again. So we get minus log, let's see, do I want a minus or I think a plus log 3. No, I want a minus log 3, sorry. Plus log 4. So this is 1 half log 2 plus log of 2 thirds plus log of 4 thirds. So this is 1 half log of Wallace's product, okay, which is why, so now if you believe that Wallace's product is equal to pi over 2, then you will get, by some sort of simple calculus, you will get exactly the right value for zeta prime is 0 is minus log square root of 2 pi. And let me just remark, I mean, there's also, I suspected I might not have enough time to say anything about this, but let me maybe take 2 minutes and just say that so the typical proofs of Wallace's formula that are given in textbooks involve various calculus techniques and so on. Let me just mention that there's a very nice what's the guy's name? Yeah. There's a very nice geometric proof of Wallace's formula. I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce it, but someone whose name is Wasland, I think. And so what he does is he says, well, let's look at the products. So Wallace's formula is 2 over 1 times 2 over 3, etc., etc. Look at this product. Let me make sure I say this right. 2 thirds. Actually look at this product. just clearly relate the wallet, the relationship between this and Wallace's product is that, for example, for n even, so for example, the product of the first n terms of this is 2n, so I call this Sn here, 2n over Sn squared. I mean, the details aren't so important. What's very nice, so you look at these numbers here, you mark them off, so I guess you call S0 is 1, and then S1, 3/2. So then you form this grid using these the Sn's. So a simple algebraic manipulation allows you to compute that if I look at the area, so the area of this shade S0 is 1, this shaded area is 1. If I then take these three areas and these three rectangles and add up their area, you get 1. Take the next bunch of rectangles and add up their areas, you get 1. So this algebraic computation allows you then to say, well, if I go all the way out to Sn, this allows you to estimate that Sn lies between, or rather I say Sn squared is less than or equal to n plus 1 over, And from this, you deduce Wallace's formula without any calculus, by a sort of simple geometric argument. So maybe I'll stop right there. I'm sure they do, and I think, yeah, so I mean, well, for example, it's not every method, you know, I list over here, I have these three methods of summation. Not every method of summation satisfies the third condition. So depending on whether or not you think a method of, you know, so in other words, if I take so you may have a method of summation which both of those series, which this series is summable and this series is summable, but this formula is not true. You might view that as being in some sense a contradiction. But if you actually want methods of summation for which apply to exactly the same series give you two different answers, I have to admit right off, I'm not sufficient of an expert in this to have an example straight off the top of my head. And one thing I recommend to anybody who's curious about this is, I should have mentioned this before, there's a book by Hardy on divergent series, which is an exhaustive discussion of methods of summation. I mean, I guess the other answer to your question is, in some sense, it's probably true in a sort of completely spurious sense that, you know, all I have to do is come up with sort of two analytic functions which I can give a plausible argument that, you know, their values at some point sum the same series, but yet the functions are sufficiently different. I'd have to think about that. But yeah.
Sorry. is the changing the order of series and also grouping them.
Yeah.
So if we are able to do these things, I think for the series 1 minus 1, 1 minus 1, 1 minus 1, I can get whatever number you like.
That's a good point. I should have met, so notice one of the things that I never did was exactly that. Right? So no, it's certainly true that if I take so the one of the things we're taught in calculus is that if you take a series which converges conditionally but not absolutely, then you can get, as you say, absolutely anything for the sum. So one thing that, yeah, I should have said this. So when at the very beginning, when I sort of wrote down these rules, so here is sort of a version of the distributive law, and we also had, the associative law. We also had a version of the distributive law. So, for example, saying that if I take a series and multiply through by some constant, you should expect that that has the effect of multiplying the sum by the constant. But what I should have said is that, you might want to allow this version of the distributive law, but you, the associative law. But one thing you certainly don't want to allow is, for example, associative and commutative. You really don't want to start switching things around. So these, this notion of dealing with divergent series very much has to do, one of the things that's sort of a given is you preserve the order of summation. Well, partly for that reason, namely that